You're listening to DraftKings Network.
On April 26th, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vanderkoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. Only in theaters April 26th. Rated R.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Big Suey, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
Welcome to Meadowlark is 37. Who makes the game? Kate Fagan is here. Amin El-Hassan is here. I'm Howard Bryant. The phrase, who makes the game, is a play on the infamous recording of ousted Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling, who said on tape, do I make the game or do they make the game? They, of course, were the players. But in this case, we're going to talk about the culture itself, what each sport asks of its players, and how they're expected to conform to its culture. Earlier this year, the Miami Marlins held a team meeting in part to discuss the style of play of some of its players, particularly Jazz Chisholm. Baseball by nature asks that its players be even-tempered. It's a long season. The game frowns on drawing attention to oneself because it's such a humbling sport. But what happens when the game is trying to grow, appeal to new, different people? Basketball was once a city Jewish game as much as it was a Midwestern game. Then it became a Black urban game, and it has been one ever since, even as it becomes international. Tennis is a country club game that demands, at least culturally, decorum. But a new generation of players add a new style to the gentility. Nick Kyrgios is a tennis player influenced by basketball style. After each win, Francis Tiafoe imitates LeBron James, not Arthur Ashe, or Roger Federer. This is a different question from the unwritten rules, which is about the violation of certain expected codes of behavior and the sanctioning of that behavior. This conversation, who makes the game, is a question of culture itself. Must Nick Kyrgios act like a quote unquote traditional tennis player? So do European players need to quit flopping? Must players adapt to the culture of the sports they enter? Or do the sports need to accept that culture is nothing but a set of traditions that the players inherit, and those traditions are always subject to change? And here we are, Amin, Kate, me, and whatever hotel room I'm in. I actually really like this topic because it's very, very different from the unwritten rules where we're talking about sanction. Whenever we talk about unwritten rules, like we all understand the rules. And you're not supposed to violate these rules. And if you violate these rules, we're going to police you. But with this topic, who makes the game? It really is about the game itself. And I was thinking about this when I was watching Wimbledon, and everybody makes such a big deal about Nick Kyrgios. And the real conversation about Kyrgios as a player is hip hop basketball kid. You can see that's his influence. He walks around wearing his Jordans, and he walks around with the, you know, with the tank tops, the Michael Jordan tank tops, and you can see how much it drives people crazy that he's not acting like a quote unquote tennis player. And then I started thinking as we were going on this, that this is not the same as the unwritten rule, because people are, so we're saying, what actually makes a tennis player? Why do you have to, at some point, I've always made this argument that the culture changes you before you change the culture. And what happens when you walk into a culture and you've got the mentality of one sport, but you're playing another sport?
Yeah, it got me thinking, Howard, about how understanding like the origin of each game and where it was invented and first played is always really, it's helpful as a foundational piece. Of course, things do like dramatically change after that, but like obviously my wheelhouse, Amin's wheelhouse, being basketball, I was thinking about like you go back to the very beginning in 1892 and Naismith inventing the game for a particular reason, which is to have an indoor sport that isn't physical because you're going to play it in some form of gymnasium in the winter months of the like of a New England winter, mm-hmm. when you can't be outside playing football. So you have like at the core of basketball, you have some idea of like fighting is net fighting in like the sense that we see in hockey or in other is never going to be part of basketball because of like the foundational origin story of what the game was. And so there's like pieces of foundation in each sport's origin story. But then comes this conversation we're having now, which is what the actual culture of the game is. And obviously the culture of the game is vastly different than New England winters and James Naismith. And that's where the conversation begins for me, because what we're talking about is like, we each live through one generation of seeing a sport shift, and maybe numerous, but as we're paying attention to basketball right now, like we've seen the culture of it shift. And I mean, I'm sure you've seen it shift from where it was in the late 90s to where it is now. And this isn't really the unwritten rules. It's sort of like what makes up a basketball player or a tennis player. And I feel like going back to the origin is one piece, but then another piece is like looking at all of the influences, it both gender, race, and especially in basketball, like the international influence is one that like we've seen an influx of in the NBA.
Listening to Howard's intro there, the idea of culture changing as a movement is the thing I always think about is the merger of the ABA and the NBA.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
The NBA was a very staid, stale style of basketball, and the ABA is what I've said for years now. ABA basketball more greatly resembles modern day basketball than NBA basketball prior to the merger. What the players brought with them was a different cultural, view or perspective of the game, of how the game should be played, of how players should play, how they should behave. All of that was ABA culture, the freewheeling style, the improvisation, the little bit more flash, right? The three-point line, for crying out loud, which people decried as a gimmick. The dunk contest in your All-Star weekend. All of these things are ABA relics, not traditions carried on from the days of Cousy and Havlicek. So, and in essence, even though the ABA was the smaller league, the less financially solvent league, the weaker league, the league that lost the name, the league that lost the records, right? The league that lost every team in their league other than the four that came over, the Nuggets, the Nets, the Spurs, and the Pacers. Even though on paper it was an annihilation, a consumption of the NBA consuming this ABA thing and spitting out a carcass, ultimately, the cultural legacy is that of the ABA. They changed the way basketball is played forever. And I'm trying to think of, you know, because I'm very, in my mind, as we're having this conversation, I'm trying to balance the difference between unwritten rules and culture of the game. And to my mind, that's the one that is strongest about this is how they change.
Well, and let's stay on that, because to Kate's point about when you follow the history of basketball, you can't do it without following who plays the game. Basketball used to be, has always had been at some level, a Midwestern sport. But it was also a city Jewish game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the NBA, really, until you start getting into the mid-60s, the early mid-60s. And so this is the game that you, as a basketball player, are playing. Right? You're playing a game with these cultural roots. And then, to your point, you start getting into the early 70s. And obviously the ABA is formed in 67, and you begin to start playing the game differently. The game itself is being played differently. And to the point where, as the game is played differently, and this is where we are not talking about unwritten rules, because that's about policing. This is about the actual sport itself. The rules change. You couldn't play ABA basketball in the NBA because the rules were different. They had outlawed the dunk. They had outlawed the golden, all of these different things that the game had to adapt to. But by the time, I remember by the time you got to the mid 70s in the NBA ABA difference, and of course you always knew because of the ball, the red, white, and blue ball, was the way the coaches really did stay on you if you were a little too flashy. If you put the ball between your legs to get by defenders, if you did any of that stuff, the culture of the sport was telling you, you were not playing the game the right way, right? You were culturally violating how we played this sport. And to this point, which is once again, why it's different from unwritten rules, that what is the purpose of this? Obviously, you could make an argument that the reason why you didn't do that stuff was because it was just too risky, that there was too many turnovers or whatever. But as the game has become more and more athletic, you can't get by a player staying on your right hand only. They'll be all over you. There's actually a utility to that flash today.
What's interesting for me, Howard, in listening to you talk about that, like the culture shift in the game and how 60s, 70s, all of a sudden things that were more flashy, they were frowned upon at certain points before they started to become more embedded in the game. When I think about how gender impacts, let's just say basketball, I even through 10 years ago, even as a woman playing basketball, you were taught all along the way that you had to be team first because athleticism wasn't as high. It's all of those reasons that you couldn't be super flashy. It wasn't an individual game. Like, and all of the tropes that we hear people still say, and that I've talked about in earlier iterations of Metal Lark or on the Levitard show of Amin, I'm sure you've heard it, like the women's game has better fundamentals. It's like right. This sort of nod that they want to give to women as like a, yeah, cool. I'm not a misogynist. The women play the game this way, and that's and they do it, you know, better than men. But you actually grew up in the game thinking that you had to play that way. And I bring this up because, as Howard and I talked about offline just before this, this interesting thing happened when I went to the University of Colorado, which was I had grown up in the game in the 90s in the U.S., which was still, like, you had to be team, you had to be pass first, you couldn't be showy. But the game that European women were learning was the exported NBA game from the late 90s, early 2000s. So, like, they were watching Allen Iverson, they were watching Vince Carter, Tracy McGrady. And so when players from, Serbia, Italy, other places came and played Division I women's basketball, they had their culture of their game. They hadn't learned that bullshit about fundamentals.
Right.
They had been watching Allen Iverson. And so that was the culture that they brought. And there was like a real clashing. And this was like, 2004, 2005, where we had one player on our team who was from Serbia. And she just had grown up watching, Vince Carter. So she was like one-on-one all the time. And then our team culture And our coach was like, no, that's not how the women play the game here. So I think, and I'm wondering, I mean, too, if like there's any version of that that kind of happened in the NBA, maybe differently, but about that export import.
Oh, well, I mean, that's interesting. Man, I have so many thoughts because I think about a player like Cappy Pondexter, who, you know, played for the Phoenix Mercury when I worked there. And Cappy played, you know, like, when I say like a guy, I don't mean like a guy as a kind of a value judgment.
But I think that's fair. I think that's fair because the culture of basketball, and this is something we'll get to, is like, right. It's set by men. It's set right. by the men's game. I mean, the women grow up following, they have, you know, they've had Jordan posters on their,
right.
they didn't have Cynthia Cooper posters. So it's like, I always feel like when somebody says Cappy Pondexter played like a guy, I know exactly what you meant. She grew up watching right. the NBA.
and more than that, she grew up playing basketball, playground basketball in Chicago, which has a very specific style. Chicago players, for instance, are really, traditionally, really good at getting to the rim. Reason why is you're playing outdoors and you shoot a jump shot, and God knows which way the ball is going to go. So there's an emphasis, and I believe New York City guards are the same way.
Point guards take it to the basket.
Take it to the basket. And so Cappy played like that. She was strong, and she had a very tight handle, and she was able to absorb contact and finish over bigger defenders. It's the reason why, this is years ago, but there was like tapes would come out in the summertime of Cappy playing pickup ball.
Yep, yep.
With NBA players and completely holding her own because she played a style that was congruent with the culture of the men's game rather than the women's game. In terms of in the NBA, the example I think of is like Jason Williams.
Yeah.
You know, being very flashy early in his Sacramento career. And then when he got traded to Memphis, Hubie Brown really kind of put all that stuff on the shelf and said, I need you to be a point guard. I need you to run the team and do certain things. Rafer Alston is another example. This guy is a legitimate playground legend. This guy was famous before he played a second of college basketball, let alone NBA basketball. But when he got to the league, there was no appetite for the Skip to My Lou show. They wanted Rafer Alston, and he ended up having a very productive NBA career as a more conservative point guard and not so much the flashy stuff that he did on the playground. It still wins out. You know, that thing that Howard was talking about in basketball, it still wins out. It's just even the conservative styles of today would look so radically flashy and out of this world pre-NBA-ABA merger.
Yeah, but here's something that we have to acknowledge when it comes to basketball that just doesn't exist in other sports. Basketball does the best job of adapting to the people who play it. You don't really have those culture wars in basketball because over the years, now, it wasn't always that way because in the early 70s, there was a lot of resistance to the game becoming black. Mm-hmm. And not just in terms of the demographics, but in terms of the style. There was a lot of resistance. And I think maybe at some point, they just sort of threw their hands up. And but like, this is how the game is played. And it's now 80% black. And there's nothing we can do about it. There's one piece of this that I do want to talk about specifically. And that is trash talk. Now, mm-hmm. I am not of the generation where I saw the shift. When I started playing, everybody was in each other's faces, right? I mean, I was 9 or 10 years old in the late 70s, early 80s. By that point, trash talk was part of the NBA. And I really wonder who we could get on this program at some point to sort of, to see one of those transitional figures who remembers when you didn't really do that up and down the court, and then when you did, and then when all of a sudden it became a very specific part of the game. And the reason why I want to talk about trash talk is because I'm thinking about Nick Kyrgios, who brings a basketball mentality to a sport where you're supposed to be genteel. You're supposed to be essentially kind to each other when you play tennis.
And he's a very big basketball fan. I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, he's transitioning or transferring things from a sport that
and
he enjoys.
And you bring the basketball onto the court, onto the tennis court.
Right. It's interesting. I never thought about a day when people didn't talk trash. I thought that it always existed since the days of...
It may have. And like I said, I don't know if it... because
back to Greek and Roman times.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about.
I don't know if because basketball is such a physical, one-on-one, everybody's sweating on each other game where there's so much communication, you know, one-on-one with each other, even though to Kate's early point, it was supposed to be the non-contact sport. Basketball is the most personal game.
Intimate.
Baseball has always had bench jockeying, you know, and it was very, you know, very rooted much in race and ethnicity. When the game was segregated, it was rooted in ethnicity. When the game wasn't, it was rooted in race. And so they've always had that trash talk thing going on in baseball in a certain way. But in basketball, now it is such a huge piece of the game that you actually see the game refereeing it. One of the reasons why the game is officiated the way it is to essentially, it is the legacy of the Malice of the Palace. But that one piece of the sport, it has evolved to the point where it is now a staple of basketball. No matter what level you play basketball at, somebody's in your face talking shit to you.
Well, Amin might have, I don't know, I don't want to set you up to fail here. I mean, you might have more understanding of the legacy of trash talking in the NBA, but from a very personal standpoint, I have over the last 2 years gone to see my nephew play both basketball and baseball, and he's like 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And maybe this has always happened, but all of those kids on his team have watched Steph Curry, and the way they mimic his body language and his behavior, it is really uncanny. And even on the baseball field, you'll see them, like, they don't wear batting gloves anymore, but they'll turn their, like, back pocket out to mimic as if a batting glove is hanging out the back of it. Huh. And so it's like, I no doubt these things have accelerated as we've gotten more intimate and more close-ups of, like, you know, Curry and the players of today. But, yeah, it's like, my nephew and the kids that he plays with, they are already doing the body language, and some of them are already doing the trash talking that they see from all of, whether it's LeBron to Curry, and that started when they were like 7. So I don't know if Amin, you know, like from the history of basketball, like when the first generation was that was doing that, but it's very clearly how it's being perpetuated.
I'm going to find this out, Kate Fagan. I'm going to find this out just as...
Yeah, there's got to be a great story.
Exactly. Along the His Girl Friday thing, I need to find the etymology of when...
Hot stove.
Of hot stove. When were those transition years? And because it is completely significant, because if you are going to play basketball, that's the culture.
Yes.
Right? That's how it is.
You can't step onto a basketball court and be like, did you hear what that guy just said to me? Rude. Right? They kind of go hand in hand. You have to. That's interesting. I I'm not sure. Because here's a juxtaposition for you. Football is a sport where they try to actively legislate out trash talk.
Taunting.
And they try with all their might, right? We're going to extract the joy out of all of this.
Is there joy?
I think it's an absolute joy that comes out of it.
At least for the fans, it seems like joy. It inspires some level of joy.
And I think for the players engaging in it, they like doing it, man. Like, you know, I one of my good friends is Eddie Johnson, right? Former Phoenix Sun, former Houston Rocket.
Eddie Johnson.
Not fast Eddie Johnson.
Not fast.
The other Eddie Johnson. The one that played with Charles and Hakeem in Houston hit that shot. And you know, and you talk to any players that played in his era, and they all have the same answer. Like, who was your favorite guy to talk trash with? And it's Bird. Because Bird would say the most outlandish shit and then go do it, right? You know, hey, you want to, I'm going to, like, what's the thing? They call timeout and he comes out of timeout. All right, here's the play. And he breaks down the play to the defender. So this is going to happen. And I'm going to end up catching and shooting right there in that spot right in front of the bench off of my left foot, falling the wrong way. And then he'll go do it. And, you know, they all hated him, obviously. But there's a part of you that's kind of like, son of a bitch, he did it. even as a target of trash talk, as the perpetrator, absolutely there's a joy in it. But even as a target of trash talk, there is a communal experience that's happening there where we're all experiencing the culture of this game real time.
Okay, there's nothing better, though. Let's just put it out there. You know, there's nothing better in the history of trash talk to me than Larry Bird walking into the three-point contest and looking at everybody and going, which one of you motherfuckers is coming in second?
He's coming in second.
that's the best. But here's a good transition. I am at Wimbledon.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about can you take culture of this sport and move it into culture of that sport. I'm at Wimbledon, and Serena is playing, and, you know, it's Wimbledon, so you got to wear the all whites, and the royal box is there, and it's got all these race, class, gender things. And by the way, speaking of gender, for the first time since 1877, when the tournament was first played, they finally got rid of the prefixes, meaning Miss Williams. They didn't say Miss,
yeah.
They used to say it was Miss Williams versus Miss Hingis. And now that's all gone for the first time. But I'm at center court watching this match. And I don't remember who Serena was playing, but it was some Eastern European, and, you know, everybody looked at her like she was about to be devoured by the great Serena Williams. And here comes Serena, 5'9", 160 pounds, ripped, bringing it like an athlete. Not like this is some sort of genteel country club sport. Every forehand, whoosh, and a grunt. And you could see the little blue hairs, all the white sitting in the crowd. And they were both fascinated and offended in some of the most racially obvious ways. And I'm looking at this, and you could hear people afterwards talking about how it's not even fair, you know, Serena against these poor little girls. And I remember thinking, she's an athlete. What do you expect? You are supposed to bring, and there was a real argument in tennis, and there has been, I think it's changing now, finally, but that you're not supposed to quite hang on the rim in tennis.
Is the allegation that she is grandstanding, showboating, et cetera, or is it kind of what Kate was talking about, where they're growing up playing the game under a certain expectation on the women's side, and then here come these European players in Kate's case, and in the case of Serena Williams?
The allegation is transition from country club to sport.
But it's acceptable on the men's side, though.
That's the point. Kate, go ahead.
Well, I think I forget which Meadowlarkers it was, but when we were doing the review of King Richard, one of the things that we talked about was his Howard actually telling you, yeah, I looked at tennis, I saw opening for an athlete to come in and dominate. And on top of that, it's a sport that has money in it on the women's side, unlike a lot of them. And there's like this wide open market to just come in and dominate. And I feel like one of the pieces of culture is that there seems to be like an acceptance for certain generations along the way where it's like, oh, well, this is how we play tennis or whatever sport. And so no one really even thinks to break that mold.
That's
and then
right.
Someone comes along and sees an opportunity and saying, well, tennis is drawing mostly, almost entirely white women who look a certain way and play a certain way. Well, that's a huge opportunity.
That's
if you're
right.
going to bring a new kind of like dedication and sport to the game. And I feel like that is something that changes the culture radically when there's just sort of like this preconceived idea, this is what this sport should be. And you're like, wow, well, that's a huge opportunity. If I don't agree with your set of standards and I'm willing to come in and bear the brunt of breaking them, because obviously there's a huge cost to that. And that seems like a huge culture shift as well.
2 points. Richard Williams said to me, we were sitting there at Wimbledon, and he said, I was watching this game on TV, and I said, imagine bringing black athleticism to this sport. And he wasn't just talking about the physical athleticism. He was talking about the mentality. If you bring that to the sport. And now when you're trying to grow the sport, when people are like, okay, we need more players, we need different players. To Tennis's point, people get upset about Kyrgios because Kyrgios has a lot of punk in him. The type of stuff that you look at Draymond Green and you go, oh, that's just Draymond.
Yeah.
But in the way, because you're not even supposed to talk to the other guy across the net. You're not supposed to communicate with him except or her when you're playing. And so there's an exchange at net between Stan Wawrinka and Kyrgios, and it's picked up on the mic. He tries to get into Wawrinka's head by saying, hey, sorry, mate, but Kokkinakis banged your girlfriend. Right? And he got fined huge for that, right? Now, that's in the NBA, no one's saying anything about that. I mean, Kevin Garnett is all over dudes. I mean, it just all the types of things come out. Can you take these things and just zeroing in on someone like Kyrgios and that sort of attitude, can you bring that to tennis? Or does tennis have to be like, how do we get you back in line? We don't do that here. Who makes the game?
Two guys here from my friends over at Simply Safe. Springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at Simply Safe Home Security, the only home security system I use and recommend. I've had it in my home for many, many years. I love it. Springtime to me, we love to travel. And I love the fact that no matter where I am in the world, I can keep an eye on my home thanks to Simply Safe Home Security. Simply Safe blankets your whole home in protection. It has sensors to detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more, plus a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than a dollar a day. Simply Safe has given me and many of my listeners real peace of mind. I want you to have it too. Get 20% off your system today when you sign up for Fast Protect monitoring at simplysafe.com/DLB. That's simplysafe.com/DLB. There's no safe like Simply Safe.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It's almost like Kyrgios, if we're using this logic, or Serena, Richard Williams, and then Serena and Venus. Like, they've spotted a weakness in the sport.
Market inefficiency.
And Kyrgios too, because if no one is trying to get a mental advantage over, if the opposition isn't used to trash talk, and you're good at trash talk, that can occasionally be an advantage to you.
100%. And Kyrgios brought that up in his match against Tsitsipas the other day, because, you know, Kyrgios is muttering, and you can see it got directly in Tsitsipas's head, where he's like, dude, we're here to play tennis. We're here to play tennis. And Kyrgios was like, well, if you just, he pulled a Kobe, like a Kobe meme. He goes, he's soft. He's soft, you know, and told him he was soft.
Let me ask you this, Howard, because we started this conversation with you saying more often the culture changes you rather than you change the culture. If you have these players who are exploiting this market inefficiency of tennis players, yeah, like the mental toughness angle of being able to withstand trash talk, how does the culture change in that regard? Do you just see more and more people start to do this? Like, so I think, what was it? Kyrgios was fined, what, $10,000, right?
For the Kokkinakis thing, and right. Not only, but then was essentially threatened with suspension. You can stop needling people and stop acting this way, because this is how the sport works. And yet, whenever you talk about it, the younger generation and a lot of people, like, well, the game has gotten too bland. We need more spice. We need to go back to the 70s where Nastasi and Jimmy Connors were yelling at each other, and there was the bad boy. The bad boy is dead in tennis because Federer and Nadal decided that they changed this, that being a world number one meant you now had to be like regal. You had to be, you had to carry yourself like a champion. Whereas tennis was always bad boy central, you know, these guys, McEnroe, you know, boys behaving badly. And on the other side of it, with the women, it's not the trash talk. Because on the women's side, people sort of love that sort of totally misogynist cattiness. They all wait for the frozen handshake. How are they going to meet each other at the, you know, at the net when the match is over? Are they going to embrace because the guys are much, much better at that? Martina brings this up all the time. You know, like when the women shake hands, with the exception of Serena and a few other players, it's usually kind of cold at the handshake. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. I just played my ass off 2.5 hours against you when I lost. What, do you want a hug? I don't want to hug you right now. And so once again, it goes back to, here are the cultural overlays. And with, and this is why I bring this up, is because tennis as a sport, and we're going to get to hockey in a second, but tennis as a sport is fundamentally different because the handshake is the only time these two players touch each other in the entire match. Mm-hmm. So there's an expectation of when these two gladiators finally meet, how are they going to actually approach each other? And so, you know, can you have these different, because the cultures of the sport are different, can you just take these overlays and place them on each other? I don't think you can.
Well, one thing I was thinking, Howard, while you were talking about tennis, was a thing I talk about a lot with my wife, because she's in the yoga world, was my surprise that the yoga world has way more anger and cattiness and competition in it than you would ever think. Because obviously it's supposed to be kumbaya, but then in addition,
the whole point.
Right, right. But what we always talk about, or my perspective on it, is, well, of course, if you've got a, you know, an activity or a sport where you are supposed to behave a certain way that exhibits all of these high level qualities, but that's not humanity, that's not reality, then they're always going to come out in other ways, in passive aggressive ways, depending on what the culture of your space is. And in that case, I'm talking about yoga, but I think it translates to tennis in a lot of ways, because not that we don't see cattiness in basketball, but you are putting forth energy, and hopefully, like, you're during the process of playing, you're also letting out a lot of that animosity and anger because you're bodying up to somebody, or you are trash talking a little bit. Now, when the tennis's culture, especially on the women's side, is you're supposed to be prim and proper, and I know that has shifted much in the last generation, but of course it's going to explode out in other ways. This is not something that, like, you can avoid. It's just energy has to go somewhere. So in tennis, if you've got all of these rules, how is that energy then coming out in these sort of passive aggressive ways?
Kate, does it work? I know you're not a huge tennis person, but does it work to trash talk each other in that sport?
Right.
And I'm asking you, can you apply that? If you're watching a tennis match and they're yapping at each other, they're not even supposed to talk to each other culturally.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, I haven't really thought this through, and Howard, obviously, you can respond to this too, but in basketball, one thing about trash talk that was always true for me was that, yes, some of it was 100% real and you truly hated someone, or mm-hmm. But a lot of it was like, part of it was always an undercurrent of cheeky fun. Like there was a wink, wink, you're in on the joke.
Yeah.
And a lot of trash talk, like, even though you want to beat that person, there was love underneath a lot of it. And I think that can only come out if you're actually, like, in physical proximity at certain times. Whereas, like, in tennis, how can you have a cheeky undercurrent of genuine love and competition when you're however far it is? What is it, Howard? 40 yards apart or whatever it is?
Feet, yes.
So, 40 feet. Sorry, 40 feet, my bad.
So okay, here's why I disagree. I think there is a love there, but it's not love for the object of the trash talk.
It's the game.
For the game, for the culture. Yes. 1,000%. I think of like Dennis Rodman playing against the Miami Heat and Alonzo Mourning, and they're lining up for you know, free throw, and you know, everyone's kind of, you're perpendicular to the basket, and Dennis Rodman turns and he just faces Alonzo the whole time and just stares at him. And you know, Alonzo is clearly bothered by this. And Dennis Rodman has a big smile on his face. That's such a deep connection with, I just enjoy. He didn't hate Alonzo, right? He's just, hey, this is fun. And this is all part of the game. There are people, if you play pickup ball, you know the guy. You know, he may have never met him, but like the moment you step on the floor, he's got a nickname for you, and he's like, it's all, and then you lose, and the next team comes on, and then he's got a name for that other guy. Like, is this is just embedded in the culture of the game? And that's why I asked Howard, like, well, how does it change? Because there's a world, I think, where 20 years from now, everyone's like Nick Kyrgios. Everyone's talking trash. Like, this becomes the norm within the sport. And so how does that transition come about?
Yeah, and I think that that is, and that is the big point here, which is, I don't know if the tennis world wants that, even though you do hear a lot of people saying, we need more spice. We need, you know, enough of all this niceness. We don't really need that. We want the game to have a little more edge to it. It's like when I remember time, you know, running ball, and there's always one dude, every time he took a shot all day, I'm like, do I have to hear this again? All day. and that's how basketball players sort of get back and forth at each other, right? And you do, there is. The one thing I find fascinating about the basketball culture is that for as much as the sport is trying to police it because of the legacy of the malice at the palace, and because every single time the whistle blows, they're trying to decide if it's a flagrant one or a flagrant two, and they got to go to the monitor or whatever. At the end of a basketball game, of every basketball game, those dudes are brothers. They actually, you know, when you watch the way baseball players walk off the field, they're not tight. Watch the way hockey players, only at the end of a playoff series. And I find that juxtaposition really interesting, because during the 48 minutes, everybody's all over each other, but it's almost as if the players understand each other better than the people who run the sport do.
And I don't know, I mean, this could be stretching too hard, but basketball, there's a lot of creativity in basketball, which allows for more expression and whatever release of the angst that can build up because of all of what could go wrong in a game and you not playing, you know, all of the struggles of a game. I do wonder if we look at every sport and you look at what the sport allows you to express as you're playing it because of the parameters of the sport, how that funnels into the culture. Because, I mean, I don't play tennis. I mean, but everything you've said, Howard, and when we talked to Brian on an earlier episode, is like the precision of tennis.
Yeah.
Certainly there's creativity at times, I assume, but it feels like it's a very precise game, which isn't a ton of creativity.
Depends on who's playing. And that's why people love Roger Federer, because he is a master at the improvisation skill, the hand. Movement, the creativity on the shot, and all of those different things. That's why people love watching Monfils play. Same thing, that sort of French creativity. People love that. And at the same time, there are people who just wonder if it's professional sometimes. Not Federer, obviously, but Monfils, Kyrgios, they get into it. And they have unbelievable hands, and they've got unbelievable skill. Where you do get that love in tennis is usually like on a net court, where they sort of give each other the sorry, not sorry wave, because that wasn't a clean hit. You got the point, but you know that wasn't clean. Okay, we understand each other. Or when guys just make, or you know, players just make unbelievable shots. Let me go here. Why is there fighting in hockey?
Who knows? Chris, we're talking about Witty now. Do we have some origin of the game story that one of us knows very deeply when it comes to hockey?
I know the answer, but what I'm getting at here is when we're talking about baseball, right? In the old days, if somebody did something you didn't like, the old unwritten rules thing, you drilled them. You hit them with the ball, right? I mean, that was your way of policing the sport, okay? The argument today, and Sandy Alderson brought this up to me in the mid-2000s when we talked about this. He's like, one, the type of people playing the sport, because the game is so diverse now. You throw the ball at people, you're just going to have fights, and we can't have fights. Sandy was sort of like, I think we need a little more spice. A couple of bench clears is sort of good for morale, right? He liked to mix it up a little bit. His other point, though, was that you can't have Mike Trout at a $400 million contract getting hit with the baseball and being out for the season. You can't do that anymore. And that you can't, that this piece of the game has to be legislated out culturally. That is not the case in hockey. The reason why people fight is because it's such an edgy game. It's such a max effort game because you're carrying a weapon. You have a stick that you can wield. That the game has to be allowed to police itself. In the early in the early iterations of the sport, fighting was that policing. And that there's an etiquette to the fighting, that you don't fight someone who doesn't want to fight, that both sides have to drop the gloves. And then if you don't police the game in this way, that the game is actually going to be become more dangerous, because there has to be an understanding of what you can do, what you can't do, and the price you're going to pay for doing it. Yet in 2022, you can still literally beat the hell out of each other on a hockey rink.
Aren't there, it seems to me like there's two levels of the culture that we're talking about. One is the culture of the game itself. And then the other is the culture of the people that surround the game who are going to allow the culture to either shift or not shift. So, like, you know, our prime example being basketball, we know what the culture is. And also it seems to have a culture of evolving. Whereas I look at hockey and I don't see the culture of the game, that is, who are the rabid fans of hockey, who is playing hockey. I don't think of that as a culture that is like trying to change and like make sure they're appealing to mass America or mass world. It feels like the culture of it is very insular.
Well, see, now here's the weird part. Here's the weird part what pertains to hockey specifically. If you watch hockey played anywhere not in the NHL or not in North America, they don't fight.
And that was just going to be my point. When you watch the Olympics,
Olympic
hockey
is
fighting, and the game is incredible.
Beautiful.
It's great. It's a beautiful game. You can still hit. You can still check. You can do all those things. You can't punch each other out.
Right. Like that part, it's such a weird thing to be still a cultural staple. I used to go, the Suns owned a minor league hockey team called the Roadrunners, the Phoenix Roadrunners. And so we used to get free tickets to go watch minor league hockey. And literally the entire premise of the night is, when are we getting a fight? That's the entire point of going to a minor league hockey game. Just watching people punch the living daylights out of each other. And it was crazy to me that I was thinking about, like, the level of play is better at an NHL game, right? Skill level and all that stuff. But it's like, at its core, we all just turn into the Roman Colosseum as soon as guys drop their gloves. People in the arena want to see a slugfest, a literal slugfest out there. And that is such a unique North American experience. Like Howard said, watching the Olympics, watching Winter Olympic hockey, it is this beautiful game that's wide open and fluid, and there's no stop. It just, hey, well, these guys got to kick each other's ass. And so that's a weird thing where that's not the culture of the sport.
That's the culture of American sport.
Of the location.
Of the Canadian sport. Mm-hmm. And it's true. And I find it interesting once more, because there was a movement between the late 80s and the 90s. Eric Lindros, Mario Lemieux, Gretzky with the skill guys were like, enough of this. You know, enough of this barbarism. And the ratings dropped. And then the fighting was back.
Yeah. This is what the people want.
It made me think, what you were saying there about, like, that's the culture of North American hockey. One other piece of this, right, is that the culture of a country's influence on the way they play other sports, whatever their primary sport is, influences a lot of sports. At least that was my experience, like, playing overseas. Like, I played a year in Ireland, and one of the, obviously rugby's huge there, and then this other sport called hurling, where it's basically field hockey, but in the air.
Oh.
So you've got your weapon and the ball, and you swing it above your head.
Isn't that lacrosse?
No, it's like a field hockey stick, and you're swatting at the ball. Ooh. Yeah, it's a dangerous sport.
Dangerous game.
And it was
dangerous
huge game in Ireland, and my point being that you can also imagine that the way they officiated basketball was very different than we officiated. Like, their culture of how they played basketball was 3 to you know, five times more physical than we even play it here because of like the culture of what their society is as well. So like that feels like a separate Meadowlarkers too about how like the culture of countries impacts how they play sports.
But that's weird because that flies in the face of Wimbledon, this very like almost stereotypical English devotion to procedure and tradition and, you know, being very polite and all that stuff. And then football, English football, being like hooligan town, right? And it's like both of them.
Well, once again, that's class.
Class, yeah.
Totally. The class, very, very, very different. It's interesting, too. I remember in thinking about culture, Kate and I were talking about this before you got on. I remember one day asking Danny Ainge, whatever happened to the white American basketball player? And I said, when I was growing up, you had you and Kevin and Larry Bird and Tom Chambers and Bobby Jones and all of these players. And what happened to them? They've been replaced, obviously, now by the Lucas and the Nowitzkis and the Steve Nashes and the rest, that the best white players are no longer American. And I was like, Danny, well, basketball seems as popular as ever. Why do you think this has changed? Where has it shifted? And he was talking about, he's like, you know, white kids have more options. You know, they play more lacrosse now. They go and do other things. They'll go play the piano. And he was talking about how, and I thought this was really interesting. He said that white kids don't want to be minorities.
Mm.
And that he says, when Larry and Kevin and I played, we wanted to prove we could play in the black game.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to the trash talk conversation, that they didn't want to be part of that environment. The type of environment was different. And as you know, Danny Ainge would scrap it up with anybody, right?
That
he was like, today's generation of kid, they're, he also made a, you know, that they're not as hungry, that America's too rich, that America, that from a class standpoint, basketball is very similar to soccer. It's a poor person's low overhead game where you fight face to face. And that type of game may not necessarily appeal to an increasingly affluent person. Mm-hmm. They don't need that level of conflict. And I thought that was really interesting that he put it that way. And it made me think about it in terms of the culture of the sport, like trash talk is a center of the sport and how that's going to affect who actually plays it. Do you buy, Kate and Amin, do you buy that assessment? What are your thoughts of that assessment?
Anecdotally, it feels right because every player I knew growing up on the men's side, there came a point in their AAU career where if you really wanted to be recruited, you had to stop playing for the Schenectady team and you had to go down to Albany or whatever it was. And you had to play for the best AAU team in the area. And that team, you would have been most likely one of only one or two white guys on that team.
You had to enter the black game.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That was like, you couldn't be on an AAU team with like 15 white guys, especially when you were growing up in New York, and be able to get recruited by college because you would not be seen. You would not have proven yourself. You would not, all of the reasons. And so I can see that paired with the proliferation now of lacrosse as a place where you could get a college scholarship, which is very different than 30 years ago versus what's available now in terms of getting a D1 scholarship and playing lacrosse, especially in like upstate New York.
It is lacrosse a revenue sport? Like you can actually, how many scholarships are on lacrosse? Because like baseball is non-revenue. There's only a few of them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more than there used to be. They're like, you know, like we'd have to do the research on that. Witty, if you get it, hit me with it. But yeah, the amount of scholarships compared to like the 80s and 90s is like 3 to 4 fold. So it feels like those two things combined is at least one lane of what you're talking about.
Amin, what do you think of Danny's thoughts on that?
I'm fascinated by the idea that white people, by and large, have an intense aversion to being a minority. It terrifies them in a way that is, I mean, and it could be as micro as like, I don't want to go to a party where everyone there is black. And it could be as macro as what we're seeing nationally in a lot of the political discourse of we will not be replaced and that kind of weird xenophobic rhetoric or not even xenophobic, but whatever you want to call it, whatever the phobia is that is. It is fascinating to me, the idea that, I've never thought about that, not for a second. The idea that part of the reason why there aren't as many white players in basketball is because they just, at some point, when they ascend, if they're good enough, they ascend to the level that Kate just described. Look, if you're good, you want to show the powers that be, you're good. You're going to have to enter the black game. You're going to have to play with and against predominantly black teams. And at that point, it's not even about not being good enough. It's just about that discomfort of being.
I want to be in that environment.
Yeah, to be a minority. Regardless of what that environment is, it's just one in which I am not the dominant part of the dominant group. Which, of course, as black people, that's life.
That's right? Life, like, right? Yeah. Well, and everybody knows, like anybody who's played in the city game, what's the thing that they say about the one white kid on? Who's got the white boy? He don't even have a name.
No, he'll get a name. They'll say, who's got Tyler Hero? Who's got Manu Ginobili? Who's got Stockton? Who's got Mark Price? Who's got Luka Doncic? Right. Like, you're going to get a name. They're not going to call you.
Exactly. And here's as we start to round this down, let's take that, the idea of not wanting to be the minority from a white standpoint playing basketball, to the class element of minorities in tennis having to adjust to this snooty country club mentality there. Can you bring the black game, the Nick Kyrgios basketball thing? Can you bring that to the country club? This is sort of the essence of what we're talking about in terms of the cultures of the sport. Because you watch Francis Tiafoe, when he wins, he does his LeBron sort of thing that LeBron does. And it's so funny. You can see the young people cheering, and then you see the older people kind of going,
harumph.
What is that? Right? What is that? And, he'll take his shirt off and do his flexing and the whole thing. And that's not the way you're supposed to play or the way they say you're supposed to act tennis-wise. But if you want to grow the sport, doesn't some of this have to go?
Well, at the risk of saying the absolute obvious, it seems pretty clear that tennis, if we take the culture of tennis, what they're obviously trying to do is just, if we force Kyrgios, for example, to shift to our culture, it signals to the next generation of players who look like him, this game's not really for you.
And on top of that, this is how you have to act because we broke him.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we broke Kyrgios. So if you want to play tennis, one, you're less likely to want to if you look like him because Kyrgios got broken by the culture. Therefore, you maintain tennis's status as, like, especially in America, a predominantly white sport. And if you look at basketball and it's like, oh, well, that's the culture there. And then we just had our anecdote about white players for whatever reason not wanting to play. And it's like one of the main drivers of the culture of sport, right, is race and gender and how we want to keep things for ourselves and keep the majority in power in them.
Well, I think the one thing, because Kyrgios is Australian and he's of Greek descent, I want to say. So it's not quite race, but it is class. It is class. And it is a method of gatekeeping, right? The idea is that you're not welcome here, so why would you want to be here, right? And you hope that basically keeps them out, or if they insist on being here, they have to conform to our kind of standards and our culture. And that's all it is. It's a method of gatekeeping.
No, 100%. And I do think that is an interesting piece of this, because when we're talking about these things now, and there are some cultural areas in terms of who makes the game and all of these different types of questions, there are some areas where the sport simply doesn't allow it. Like, you have to be able to hear the umpire's call. I remember Jamel and I were out having dinner one night and tennis match was on. And she was like, why do they have to be quiet? And she's like, can you imagine a basketball game if a guy was shooting free throws and they all had to be quiet?
Yeah, that's my main argument about golf. I'm like, this is ridiculous. The best ever.
You could be able to just like scream top of the lungs and you're trying to make a putt.
I'm just saying, like, Tiger Woods, the focus, the zeroing, who's that jingling keys over there? I'm like, it's so ridiculous. You're supposed to be the greatest of all time, and you can't even handle someone rummaging in their pocket for keys? Get out of here. It's such a ridiculous thing. But again, part of that is the culture that they want to have. They want to keep people like me out of the sport, people who cannot like accept or conform to a ridiculous standard, particularly, if this is professional. Like, pros are supposed to be not thrown off by anything. Like I said, imagine being at bat, game 7 of the World Series, bottom of the 9th, bases loaded, 2 outs. I said, can everybody just keep it down? Like,
probably. My favorite thing about that, by the way, just as an aside, is when the chair ump in tennis, what he's really trying to say is everybody shut the hell up. So he says, thank you.
That's basically the ultimate of what we were talking about with the passive aggressiveness of tennis.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Thank you means shut the fuck up. Indeed. Well, in closing, I would say that I find all this fascinating because as these sports grow and as different people play them, these battles are just going to keep, they're going to stay. And here's Nick Kyrgios in the second week of the tournament has a legitimate chance to win this tournament. And he's actually begun, I'm not going to say he's done a complete heel turn, but he now will just embrace and say, I'm one of the most important people in the sport. I'm one of the biggest draws in the sport. He's totally aware that he is that young generation and that you are going to find a next generation of players that are going to want to emulate him because he's so damn good. And it will be very interesting to see what the sport does with that. Just as it is interesting in the other sports to see how these cultures shift. And obviously basketball is the one that, as Kate said, evolves the best. Hockey's the one that doesn't evolve that much, ditto with football. And yet all of the sports continue to shift because you need, well, one, they need the revenues, and two, different people are playing. Last thoughts, anybody?
I think the umpire said it all. I need to shut the f*** up.
Thank you.
Oh, that's what Kate was going for. I'm sorry, Kate. I just stepped all over your subtle joke.
Dugatz here for my friends over at Simply Safe. Springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at Simply Safe Home Security, the only home security system I use and recommend. I've had it in my home for many, many years. I love it. Springtime to me, we love to travel. And I love the fact that no matter where I am in the world, I can keep an eye on my home thanks to Simply Safe Home Security. Simply Safe blankets your whole home in protection. It has sensors to detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more, plus a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than $1 a day. Simply Safe has given me and many of my listeners real peace of mind. I want you to have it too. Get 20% off your system today when you sign up for Fast Protect monitoring at simplysafe.com/DLB. That's simplysafe.com/DLB. There's no safe like Simply Safe.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.